I'm Stephanie Wilson, and you're listening to Freedom Over Fascism.
And the idea was pretty simple, which is if we were going to invest in state and local leaders early in their careers, and again, not on the campaign side, but on the governing side, helping them with good ideas, helping them govern effectively, as they rose up the ranks in public service, we would change the kind of the trajectory of our party and our country to have those types of thoughtful leaders at the helm.
Hi, friends. I loved my conversation today with Debbie Cox Bolton, who is the CEO and co-founder of New Deal Leaders. New Deal is a national network of progressive state and local elected leaders. Once these folks have won their campaigns, New Deal helps them formulate policy to help their communities. It also brings them together into a cohort to learn from each other and more experienced officials. New Deal is a complement to groups like Hoosier Victory Alliance and others that work with state and local pro-democracy candidates to win elections. New Deal is playing the long game. They figure if they invest in young state and local officials and help them make good policy, as those officials move up the ranks, we'll have a cadre of leaders who have more experience and more success under their belts. As we all know, over the last 50 years, Republicans have played the long game. They invested in think tanks like the Heritage Foundation. They created policymaking organizations like ALEC, which produces reactionary policies like strict abortion bans and trans healthcare bans. And they fund Republican candidates at every level, down to school boards, so these candidates don't need to face voters and account for their actions. New Deal Leaders is one of the very few organizations on the progressive side that helps state and local elected officials who often don't have a lot of policy experience. New Deal helps them develop policies for the federal money that the Biden administration passed several years ago, but is just now making its way into state and local budgets. As I talked to Debbie, it became clear once again that we have many different organizations and resources to help recruit and elect candidates to state and local offices and help them once they get there. But we could be doing a lot better knitting together an ecosystem where state and local pro-democracy leaders know where to go to join with their peers and find help when they need it. I also realized how much our organizations have in common, if only we knew more about each other. I hope we can develop a more informed way to learn from each other across the country, across the levels of government, and across the pro-democracy movement. As Freedom Over Fascism continues, we'll meet more people like Debbie. I'm looking forward to hearing what you think about this conversation. Please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or contact me directly. Before we start our conversation, I ask for your help supporting this podcast by becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. You'll find bonus content and backstage glimpses and early access to each week's podcast. Now for our conversation. Debbie Cox Bolton, welcome to Freedom Over Fascism.
Thank you so much for having me, Stephanie. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you. I would love to talk to you a little bit about the organization that you co-founded, New Deal Leaders. Can you tell us about your background and what led you to start the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for the question. So New Deal Leaders, I'll start with there, is which stands for Developing Exceptional American Leaders, is the deal, New Deal, is a national network of state and local elected officials below the level of governor all over the country who are Democrats, who are what we call pro-growth progressive Democrats. I'd say they're people who are particularly solutions-oriented. People are trying to find common sense solutions, common ground. And I'll talk a little bit about what we do, but to go to the first part of your question first, I've been working in center-left politics now for almost 30 years. I came to this kind of work, interestingly, kind of in college. I had been religious growing up, and my favorite part of being part of the church had been kind of the service aspect of being in a church, the feeding the homeless and, you know, just doing all those kinds of service things that you do. And when I kind of left the church and that wasn't a big part of my life anymore, I actually was like, oh, I can't believe that that's not something I'll get to do anymore. That's been so important to me. And someone suggested when I was in college that I go intern in Washington, D.C., and I ended up on the Hill interning. And it sounds so silly and naive and Pollyannish, but like, I literally was like, my mind was blown. I was like, oh, there are people who wake up every day thinking about how to make people's lives better. That is not, you know, through church. I mean, this is amazing to me. And so I went back home, I added a double major for poli-sci and really never looked back. I started out in campaigns and enjoyed that, but quickly kind of found my way to governing, which is really my passion is helping people govern effectively. I like to say that as the party Democrats who believe that government has an important role to play in people's lives, we have a special obligation to make it work well. So I think that, you know, right now we'll talk about where we are in the country, but you know, it's things feel so dysfunctional. And so I still have that passion for trying to help people who are governing do it well. I did a very long stint at a group called the Democratic Leadership Council, 15 years there as our chief of staff ultimately. And then a colleague of mine, a good friend of mine, Helen Milby, who really had the idea for New Deal. And I came on to help her co-found it now almost 14 years ago. And the idea was pretty simple, which is if we were going to invest in state and local leaders early in their careers, and again, not on the campaign side, but on the governing side, helping them with good ideas, helping them govern effectively, as they rose up the ranks in public service, we would change the kind of the trajectory of our party and our country to have those types of thoughtful leaders at the helm. Fast forward 14 years, we're very grateful to have been able to work with as many amazing leaders as we have. We invite people to join New Deal. And so it's a pretty selective group and we keep it capped at about 200 at any given time. Mm-hmm. And so it's just an amazing group of leaders, many of whom now people will be familiar with who've come through New Deal, like probably our most famous alum, Secretary Pete, and members of Congress and others.
Well, I think it's so important. One of the things that I think that we as Democrats were behind Republicans in was building up our bench and
absolutely
investing in younger and leaders at the state level or local even.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we do is help on the campaign side, people who don't have a clue where to start, get going. And mm-hmm. It's wonderful that people who haven't necessarily been in government also could use the help on the policy side to organize how they want to view their service. I think we're doing a lot better at some of the newer, first of all, the state level people affiliated with your group. There are so many that I want to talk to. But also, as you mentioned, we're in a moment when everything is so sharply divided. And some states like California and Massachusetts are blue. And some states like Indiana and Tennessee and all the others are really living in a different kind of world. So I would love to hear from you about what the New Deal Leaders Organization does with these new leaders, particularly in, as we call them, MAGA captured or red or rigged states.
Yeah, well, you're right. It's a really perilous time for our country. And I think, you know, the work that I've been doing for many, many years feels even that much more important to lift up these leaders who are putting themselves out there on the front lines. I'm so grateful for all the people who work in elections, and it's a super important part of the process to get the right people elected who share our values. But, you know, one of the things I've always felt, frankly, is that there's been a little bit of a dearth, particularly on the Democratic side, to your point, of people who are like, oh, well, what happens after you get elected, right? It's like, oh, we're just going to make sure the right people are elected and then everything's going to work out. And to me, I feel like that's just, that's not really how it works. And particularly right now, when the leaders are on the front lines of so much, when there is so much division, there is so much vitriol, it's hard to be an elected official, frankly. I just don't think that gets enough attention. You know, I like to call myself like the chief cheerleader for state and local elected officials. People think it's like being an elected official, it's so glamorous. Politicians get such a bad name, right? You know, and to me, that is just such a sad part of where we are, because you know these people, I know these people. People do not run, particularly for state and local office, because of the prestige or the money or anything else. It is hard work. Increasingly in this day and age, it's hard because there is so much vitriol thrown at people, right? So we have New Deal leaders in every corner of the state, blue, purple, red states. We have a guy who's an alumni now, but who was in coal country, Kentucky, in a state house seat that Trump won by 80 points or something. And I love working with these people who have figured out how to connect with leaders on the ground, particularly in red states. I mean, with their constituents on the ground, and I'm in California, but we're a national group. We're headquartered in Washington and DC, and you know what we can learn from those people to give as lessons to others. I was thinking about a leader we have right now, Brandon Whipple in Wichita. He was, he's been a New Deal leader for a long time. You know, he's one of those people, like many, who, you know, had death threats during the pandemic when he wanted to do a mask mandate in Wichita, and had some credible threats against him and his very young family. And so think about what New Deal does. We do a number of things, but we do focus on policy. We have a lot of ongoing policy working groups that are tackling some of the biggest issues that our country's facing, things like climate and democracy, and how to use all the federal dollars that are coming to states and localities right now because of the great work of the Biden administration. That's a really big part of what we're doing. We can talk about mm-hmm. that more. But so we do a lot of policy sharing, convening of people to be able to share those good ideas. But we also do some of those just lifting our leaders up, trying to elevate their voices, help them place op-eds, get their ideas out there, some skill development for them, as well as just frankly being a source of support for them and a home that they can come to talk to other people who are going through a lot of what they're going to and just trying to get up every day and govern effectively.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on the glamour part, you know, especially in these days. The first person in the season that I had is running again for city council. Mm-hmm. You may have heard in Fishers, Indiana, the library council decided to move all of the young adult books to the adult section, the ones that were problematic. And John mm-hmm. Green, the author of Fault in Our Stars, got involved, which changed the whole trajectory. And people like that on the front lines are just battling to protect the freedoms and rights of their constituents and try to get a foot in the door in these places where they sometimes are Republican because their families were and don't necessarily mm-hmm. even believe everything. I'm curious about the community that you build with the New Deal leaders. How do you bring people together and keep that community functioning? And so you guys as an organization are a resource. How do you facilitate people knowing each other and using each other as resources?
Yeah. No, I love that question because I think at its heart, what New Deal is really a community. And that's really intentional. You know, I think back to when I found my way into this work. And I think part of what really kept me in this work is this idea that there are people who are like-minded that I can lean on. I found a home almost, right? With people who are out there doing these this good work and putting themselves out there every day. So it's a really important part of what we do is for people to really feel like they are part of a community and that they have those resources. So New Deal is pretty small. And so one of the ways that we do that is to really see ourselves as a resource and a network for these folks. We don't try to do everything by any stretch, right? I think our value add, our special sauce, if you will, is finding great talent and then bringing them together. But our ecosystem does not only the 200 leaders I was talking about, which, by the way, we've chosen out of about now over 14 years, you know, thousands of nominations. So mm-hmm. we really are, you know, very lucky that we get to select really phenomenal leaders who are particularly impactful where they are governing now and have a really great trajectory going forward and staying in public service. But so it's not just those 250 we now have, having done this so long, you know, another 200 alumni who, you know, mm-hmm. either are have gone on to higher office. I mentioned Secretary Pete, but, you know, Governor Shapiro was a New Deal leader, many members of Congress, or who are, you know, no longer in office, but are running organizations or somehow still engaging in their communities in public service. So we have those folks to rely on. We have a whole network of think tanks and other, you know, philanthropy and private and public sector policy entrepreneurs that we can draw on. The in-person convenings are important. Our next, we actually are bringing everyone together. Our annual conference is always next month, November, in Washington, D.C., and we bring 70 or so of our leaders together then. And then we also do a spring event also around the country. It's been in places like Philadelphia, Detroit last year. We'll be in Phoenix this coming spring. So those in-person meetings are important, but we, you know, between the in-person meetings, it's bringing them together virtually. It's making sure that even when we are convening, there's time for people to, I think as much work gets done in the hallways as it happens in lots of conferences, right? But informal kind of, you know, hey, I've got this problem. How have you dealt with this? You know, we build in a lot of time for those conversations. And even our programming itself is very geared toward conversations around a hollow square where people can roll up their sleeves and hear from each other. So that's an important part of it. But just, you know, being a group that an elected official can call and say, hey, I'm thinking about this idea. Who do we know either within the network or other think tanks or other groups that I should be talking to if I want to launch a child savings account plan in my city? So it's like, okay, great. Tashara Jones, who's the, you know, the mayor now of St. Louis, but at the time she started with New Deal was the treasurer of St. Louis. She started one in her city. You know, we've got Jose Cisneros, the treasurer of San Francisco, started one a long time ago. So, you know, we have all these resources that we can connect people with. And I think it's that connection and that feeling of, you know, knowing that there's a group of people collectively all trying to work toward these goals that gives it that feeling of kind of a home for a lot of people.
What I love about that is the community, but also the idea that you're such a resource that nobody needs to reinvent the wheel.
Yes.
And I find, right, that in a lot of locations, when there isn't that kind of support, people have great ideas, but feel like they have to figure it out from scratch, when really around the country, there are groups or people who have figured it out.
Yeah, so, that's right. I that's a big motto of mine too. Even for our, as an organization, we don't want to reinvent the wheel either, right? There's a lot of great organizations that do all kinds of great work. And so, you know, our job is to know what they're doing and know, you know, build a relationship with them and then connect the city councilwoman in Indiana to that group that's doing something or to other leaders across the country. And I totally agree. And, you know, it's another interesting aspect of this whole thing you're kind of alluding to is, it, you know, it depends on what level of government you are, of course, and where you are in the country. We work with, you know, state senators in California who literally represent more people than our members of Congress do, because there's fewer of them, right, than our congressional delegation, and have huge staffs, right? And so what we provide them is slightly different than what we provide a city councilwoman in Lincoln, Nebraska, who has no staff, or, you know, or even a state legislator that's in a part-time legislature that share one staff. But so, you know, like I said, we can't do everything, and there's no need for us to do everything, because there's lots of good people doing good work. So it's just, it's making sure, you know, and the leaders we pick tend to share some common concerns and issues that they work on. I mentioned a couple of them. We were very big into the climate space, in the democracy space increasingly. We released last year with a number of our New Deal leaders, including Secretary of State Benson in Michigan and Secretary of State Fontes in Arizona, a democracy playbook that had 40 good ideas for state and local leaders to think about in terms of protecting the vote, increasing access to vote, maintaining election integrity, and expanding civic engagement opportunities. And we even did that as our first time we've ever done this with, like, by time frame. So if you're 2 years out from election, if you're 1 year out from election, we're about to re-release now that we'll be about 1 year out from the national election. You know, if you haven't done those things, that's okay. Now we'll focus on these things, right? So to try to really just give people the benefit, to your point, of the experience and the expertise of people all over the country, so people don't have to invent the wheel. There's a lot of really good ideas out there that you can grab and run with. We're not huge, so we don't do a lot of implementation support ourselves, but it's that connecting that I think is has been a really good, I think that our leaders appreciate. You know, one of the things that we're really focused on right now, and I think this is inextricably linked to the democracy piece is this idea of making government work better and really deliberately doing so. It feels to me like we have this amazing opportunity right now with all of the money that is coming to states and localities from the American Rescue Plan, from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Deal, from the Inflation Reduction Act, from CHIPS. And, you know, someone who works in Washington, in Washington, think, you know, for so many people that those things passed a long time ago, that was, you know, forever ago. As you well know, states and localities are just starting implementation right now. Those rules are just getting written. The money's just being dispersed. So it feels to me like it's a really important time, again, for people who care about government and making government work well, that this is a pretty unprecedented amount of money that's coming to states and localities. Not enough, even for some of the issues that we have to deal with, but a really good opportunity. So one of the things we've been doing is tracking where the money is going. We've done 3 reports on highlighting 25 different case studies of where the ARPA money, the money that American Rescue Plan money that went directly to states and localities, a lot of it's gone to housing, making small businesses whole that struggled during the pandemic, to increasing childcare opportunities. There's so many really great things that have happened with that money. And so as Democrats, I feel like, you know, we always get tagged with this, like, you just want to spend money thing. You know, it's like, no, actually we're investing, right? I love the president's framing on this. We're investing in America. And so I think it's important that we share where those investment dollars have gone and the real impact they're having on real people. And so that's something that, you know, that we're continuing to do, and hopefully we'll be doing the same with some of the other federal dollars that are rolling out now. So that's important, period, hard stop. And then we are also helping our leaders, you know, connect with administration folks, connect with the different agencies as some of this other money is rolling out, and with their staffs, to make sure that they know where those opportunities are for grants that can help their communities move projects forward that'll benefit so many people.
Well, that's fantastic, because I'm sure as a state or local leader, it's really hard to keep track of what's available and how do you apply for it. And one of the things that I do is help people with their messaging, right? And one of the most important things about messaging, as we had Anat Shankar Osorio on in May, and as she says, is to talk about the brownie, not the recipe. So how are these dollars helping people in your community? Let's not talk about the number, you know, the amount of money that's coming. It's completely useless, right? We have to figure out, you know, oh, that bridge that you drive under, oh, your commute has gotten better. Like, we have to really be better about understanding how these investments make people's lives better. And I think that knowing that you are putting, you know, these case studies together is really important, because I'm not sure that a lot of candidates and some of these places know that information is really out there.
Yeah.
And that they can use.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, I mean, truth be told, I even with our own staff, when we were doing some of this work, we would lead with the dollar number. And I was like, no, take it out, right? Because essentially, I completely agree with you. Not that it's not important, but you can't even get your head around it, right? These are, you know, $50 million here. I mean, these are really big numbers. Who knows what that number looks like? And it doesn't matter. The point is that these investment dollars are going to this many new homes that are going to house this many new families, or this many new childcare teachers, or, you know, whatever it is. And so I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I really don't know where we would be if the American Rescue Plan hadn't passed, right? I mean, if we think about how much Democrats have delivered under President Biden and Vice President Harris, I mean, it is remarkable, actually, how much was done with a government that was very close, right? That was, you know, that was, the margins were similar. And so, you know, it's actually shocking to me how much that the administration was able to get done, and in partnership, to your earlier point, with state and local leaders. So, but I couldn't agree more that when we talk about it, we have to talk about not the acronyms of the legislation that passed that nobody knows, you know, or the dollar figures, which I have no idea what that means, but it is the real impact, the real tangible things that impact, that affect people every day. And if we do that, we're in so much more solid ground to be successful politically. I think that we just have to be relentless about it between now and next November.
I totally agree with you. And we have to be very clear. There are folks that talk about, another person I had on was Simon Rosenberg, who talks a lot about how we need to be much more positive about the economy. But again, nobody knows what the economy means, right? It's about how do they feel in their homes?
Right.
Do they have a job that makes them enough money to put dinner on the table and gets them home on time to eat it, right?
That's so absolutely right.
I think we have to, as a group, learn how to talk about people and not policy.
Yeah.
Even though you're doing real policy work, and that's where the work of helping people comes, but the talking about it and getting people, you have to reach people on an emotional level. And these abstractions, even democracy is a bit of an abstraction for people.
Yeah.
And
I think that's right.
I think it's a challenge to figure out how do you talk about these things so people can really emotionally connect.
Yeah.
I don't know if you looked at, if you watched it today, Hakeem Jeffries, after our dear friend.
We're learning his name.
Mike Johnson. We are recording this on Wednesday. We're at 4:09 p.m. Eastern.
The
new Speaker of the House.
Was a minute ago. Now we know who.
We're finding out we don't actually agree with him on anything. But Hakeem Jeffries spoke after that, and he talked about all the things that Democrats are protecting. And it was a really powerful way to talk about the good that Democrats are doing. And we forget just how bad things are, even though there's the Trump sideshow right now. What's going on in court? We were in bad shape. Biden and Harris are doing such a good job.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I'd maybe make a couple points to what you just said. One is, we also have to remember, nobody's paying attention, but we mm-hmm. just have to really remember that. And I saw a poll not too long after the bipartisan infrastructure deal was passed, I think from our friends at Third Way, like 22% of people knew that legislation had passed several months in, right? So, I mean, that it's just something that, you know, we have to repeat ourselves. We have to let people know, again, not that bill passed, but, you know, that there is money mm-hmm. coming to states and localities to repair those roads and those bridges that people drive on every day, to lower, you know, heating costs, all those things that people care about. The other thing I wanted to point out about Simon Rosenberg is a good friend and a former colleague. And
yeah, you probably worked together.
We worked together. Yeah, I've known him for 20 years. And so, you know, one of the things I love about his presentation, he gets a lot of credit for being one of the only people that kept their optimism going into the last election that we were going to do better than everybody was thinking. So I give him tons of credit for that. But the thing that he's doing that I really love is this presentation he does on how much better people do economically mm-hmm. under Democrats. And this is kind of what you were alluding to. And it's so interesting because we've been doing this a long time, almost 30 years. And, you know, Democrats on the economy has always been like somehow that we are bad on the economy. Like, right. Like that is this weird, weird kind of stereotype. Right. And if you look at the numbers, unemployment numbers, GDP numbers, you know, even the debt numbers, I mean, just everything, when Democrats are in power, Americans are doing better economically at an individual mm-hmm. level. And so I just think it's so important that he's compiled all that data, and the data is important. But to your point, we've got to tell the narrative, tell the stories, keep on that. Because I really do think that it is something that is just not true. And there's an opportunity to change, I think, those long and wrong stereotypes. And also, if I can, on some of the stuff you're talking about now, mm-hmm. too, which is some of the freedom stuff, right, too, mm-hmm. like Democrats have been tagged with all these stereotypes that just don't make sense to me. And we have this opportunity to flip the script on things like freedom, where the Republicans have absolutely ceded any mantle of, authority on things like law and order after January 6th, or you know, rule of law with President Trump and the shenanigans and trying to overturn the election and all of those things. And so I just feel like, you know, and when you're talking about, you know, freedom of, you know, woman's right to choose, but yet we're not going to let you read what books you want to read. Like, there's just so many places here where the freedom thing is just completely flipped in my mind. And I think that there's, you know, there's some polling that shows that that people are understanding that Democrats are protecting those freedoms and Republicans have gone to this really extreme place that is really out of touch with most Americans. And so I think that's an opportunity that we've just got to continue to just, you know, hammer on, frankly.
Absolutely. You know, we started talking about it last year when I was working with Heidi Bidinger. We framed everything in terms of freedom. And that framing has gradually widened. So Josh Shapiro used a lot of it. Fetterman used a lot of it. Now Biden's using it. And I think it's coming more into public parlance. When we're combating Republicans' narratives, we need to be not just refuting, we need to change the entire narrative. We need to flip the way we talk about a lot of these things, investment rather than spending, all those kinds of things. And that's a lot of what I do. And there's a lot of good research on how people think and how to talk to them in ways that they can really take in a lot better. But one of the things I think as a larger unit, political unit, the country, we forget that in a lot of states, people have been so locked out of the process for so long that they don't think that they have any way of changing anything. So they don't bother because, and the person I'm having on next week, Andrea Miller from Center for Common Ground, hungry people don't vote, right? You need to deal with basic needs. You need to help people understand that they really can have an influence. And that was one of the things we found is that a lot of Democrats just don't show up because they don't think that they have a choice. So there's the myth of an undecided voter. And I think at this point that is about, are they actually going to get off the couch and go vote, or, you know, are they going to stay home?
I totally agree with you. And I guess one reaction I'm having to what you're saying is just thinking about some of what we've witnessed so far post Dobbs and the enthusiasm and the motivation of people in places like Kentucky and Indiana and Kansas, right? Coming out and saying, no, I'm not okay with this freedom being taken away. Right. And, you know, we're not even talking about the deliberate nature of trying to disenfranchise people, which is actually also happening. Right. And so the crazy stuff that's happening all over the country to, you know, roll back voter protections and, you know, either explicitly or de facto, because where you're putting polling places and where you're, you know, not giving people access to the ballot. So I think both things are true, right? There's that piece that we need to be focused on, which is just making sure that the rules and that the access to the ballot is existing for everybody, all over the country. And then there's the messaging piece. I was so heartened. I was worried heading into the 2022 election. And of course, we're Democrats. We always worry, but I'm still worried. But I was so heartened and uplifted by the fact that clearly the majority of Americans across this country said, and democracy is abstract, but I know something's going on. I can understand that I don't want to talk about this election being stolen anymore. I want to hear from people that are saying they're going to work to make elections fair and accessible, and I'm going to vote for those people. I mean, Adrian Fontes, I've brought him up before, but, you know, the Secretary of State of Arizona just comes to mind as one example. Mm-hmm. You know, Arizona, he was Maricopa County commissioner or clerk during 2020. You know, here he's running for Secretary of State against a crazy election denier, and that's, you know, Simon would get mad at me for that. We shouldn't say election denier, right? We should say, you know, people who are trying to, insurrectionists, right? That's a better word. That's what's happening. But, you know, running against somebody who was, you know, explicitly saying, basically, I'm going to make sure the elections turn out the way I want to make sure they turn out, right? And so to have the people of Arizona, just as one example, say, no, that's not really what that job is. That job is to protect our elections and for you to protect my vote however I want to vote, was super heartening.
Mm-hmm. So we've got the candidates and we have the elected officials. And then there's the, some people call it the soft side, the organizations, the nonprofits, the advocacy organizations that make a lot of it work. In Indiana, there's no voter protection. There's no nonprofit voter protection. And every candidate is, you know, responsible for herself. There's no civics education. It's really unbelievable how different places are, what kind of infrastructure exists or needs to exist. Does your organization work with any of those kinds of organizations that are trying to lift up infrastructure, or is that just you can't boil the oceans?
We do, in the sense that we try to lift up organizations, particularly where things can be replicated, right? So if we see somebody doing, we can't do that work ourselves, we're not big enough. But when we see groups that we think are doing particularly good work on voter protection, just to use that example, you know, we may lift them up, you know, so that people can from outside that state, wherever it is, can see what's happening and then maybe go back and do something similar. So we were, for example, just in Detroit for our spring event, as I mentioned, and we did a session with the Secretary of State on democracy, following up on our playbook. And, you know, she had local organizations from Detroit who she thought were doing really good work that could be replicated, and wanted to share that with the leaders that were coming in from across the country. And they were interfaith groups, and they were people who were registering and people who were protecting the right to vote. So, that we can do that. And I think that that's part of the it's an important thing, that it's just a piece, certainly, but it's an important piece to make sure that people who are doing good work get that recognition, and maybe that helps as a catalyst drive change in other places. You know, I mean, that's, and not just on the nonprofit avenue, but I was back to kind of the elected official. I have a fun story maybe, but, you know, in one of our recent working group meetings, another one of our democracy co-chairs is a great woman named Sandra Harigi in Nevada. She's an assemblywoman. She's one of our chairs. And she was making some opening remarks at one of our virtual working groups meetings. And she said, oh, Jay Chaudhry from North Carolina, Senator, I'm so glad you're here. I wanted you to know that last time we were on a call together at this for this working group, you mentioned the work you were doing in North Carolina to protect poll workers in North Carolina. And I know your bill failed in North Carolina, but I want you to know that I took it back to Nevada. And now because of you, Nevada poll workers are protected because I heard this idea and now it is law in Nevada. And so there's, you know, that kind of idea, that back to the not reinventing the wheel, that, you know, once, you know, these things that importance of sharing good ideas and having them spread across the country is a really rewarding part of what I get to do every day.
Well, that's so exciting. So this podcast, is connected to the organization Hoosier Victory Alliance, which I co-founded. And one of the things that we are trying to do is, in some ways, what you're doing is trying to remind people that we're all on the same side and that we can work together and we don't have to fight over territory. And also that the world is bigger than Indiana. We can learn from lots of different people. And so having an example like this is really great, because I think we get kind of in our silos, and we're a big country, so it's logical that would happen. But a lot of work can be done to make sure that we are working together. So thank you for that.
No, well, yeah, absolutely. I just feel like there is so much work to be done, right, in so many spheres, and you know, to the title of your podcast. I mean, we are at a really scary time for America. And, you know, it's, it is easy to believe that these things are settled, right? And that, you know, America is set in stone and we're, you know, on the path and nothing can knock us off of it. And then you're just, you know, just reminded that that's not true. And in fact, if, you know, our history has been a lesson, my favorite, David Pepper, my friend, who wrote a great book on this, you know, Saving Democracy, a user's manual, I think is the name of it. Who's great. You probably know David.
He was our first guest.
Oh, good. You know, but he's, you know, your listeners have heard it, but I just love that concept that, like, I guess it's probably human nature to not see our point in history, but every generation has had a fight, right? Whether it's the civil rights movement or World War II or, way back to the Civil War and Revolution. It's like, but, you know, it's not like it's surprising on one way, but it's important, you know, it's important to see our place in history as people who are going to continue that fight for democracy, because it's not a given, and that, you know, that there will be forces that are trying to take it away. And so, you know, it's not like, oh my gosh, how do we get here? It's like, no, this is just what has to be done. And so we're going to do it, and we're going to be diligent about it.
Absolutely. And I think we get in the habit of thinking that history is over, right?
Yeah.
That history has already happened, but it's not. You know, in 20 years, what we're doing now will be history. So it keeps going, and we do have to fight this fight every generation.
Yeah. I mean, and you're a historian, right? You know this better than anyone. It is hard to remember sometimes that we are on that line of history, right? And this will, I have to believe, you will tell me, but I mean, I have to believe that this period between COVID and our political reality will go, I mean, warrant multiple chapters in future history books, I would assume.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is fascinating. If you look 100 years ago, the people who were involved in World War I, that finished in 1918. The flu happened in 1918. And it was only 20 years later that was the buildup to World War II. Yes. And so there are lots of generations where things happen, one thing after another, after another. And there are lots of generations where, you know, we're not in a uniquely bad time in American history. There was the Civil War, after all, and there was the Civil Rights Movement, which was a pretty violent time. But it also doesn't mean that it's fixed.
Yeah,
that's right. That it's repaired. We have to fight the same battle, and it's remarkably similar to what was going on around the Civil War.
Yeah.
And by the same general actors.
Yeah.
If you look at the demography of it. So,
right, right. Well, it's not linear, right? That's the point, right? It's like you think that we tend to think that these things are settled and we're just marching upward, but it's, you know, that's not, I don't think that's how it looks. And it's not surprising, to be honest, that there are people who are looking backward at a time of great change, whether it's globalization and technology and, you know, and more empowerment for so many groups that have been otherwise unempowered, disempowered, you know, that some people are uncomfortable with that. And it's not an excuse, and I'm not saying it's okay, but historically speaking, I'm sure this is not the first time where people have said, I don't like this change. I'm going to try everything I do to hold on to or go back, you know, and that's just, we're in the middle of it. Right. And it's like, it's not going back. So, now that, you know, we got to figure out how we can move forward together and not, you know, tear each other apart, but we're going to keep marching forward. That's just what happens. You know,
this is true. And in places where they are going backward, our freedoms, where people are losing their freedoms, that's where we need to remember that it's not a straight line. And where you were saying we're marching forward, that's absolutely true. We're continuing along the timeline, but it doesn't mean that some of these things that we've fought for can't go away again. And we need to keep fighting for
that. No, that's right. That's right. And people are feeling it inequitably, to your point, right? Depending on where you're living. We have to just keep fighting, frankly.
Well, say this for every podcast, should probably have named it, you know, hope is an action verb, right? Got to keep doing the work.
That's right.
If people would like to support your organization, what can they do?
Yeah. So I think the website site's a great place to start. People can either, donate, which is always very much appreciated. They can nominate leaders who they think should be New Deal leaders. They can download our policy and, you know, take any of these recommendations we're talking about to their state legislator and say, hey, are we doing this? So at www.newdealleaders.org, you'll find policies, a place to donate, a place to nominate people, tons of ways to get engaged. So we'd love all the support and people to help join the network. But thank you so much for all the work you're doing. And it's really been lovely to be with you today.
It's been great to be with you. Thanks so much. Thank you for listening to Freedom Over Fascism. Kudos to our editor, Benji Wilson. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and please drop us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts.